and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm Ayen Deng Bior in Washington. Here are some of the stories we're covering today, Thursday, October 31st, 2019. The president declares a state of emergency in parts of South Sudan.
The impact of these floods in the livelihoods of our people, exactly. One of the things that farms, people actually with their farms and all this are completely washed out.
And President Kiir cancels a shipment of crude oil.
The president was not even aware of the allocation of that 18 cargoes. So the cancellation came as a result of the fact that the president did not know.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. President Salva Kiir has declared a state of emergency in parts of the country affected by flash floods. The Minister for Humanitarian Affairs and Disaster Preparedness says more than a million South Sudanese are displaced by the flooding caused by months of torrential rains. Lasuba Memo reports for VOA from Juba.
Most South Sudanese affected by floods are in the Bahar El Ghazal and the Upper Nile regions. At a news conference in Juba yesterday, Minister for Humanitarian Affairs and Disaster Preparedness Hussein Mar Nyot said the floods have destroyed hundreds of farms.
The impact of these floods in the livelihoods of our people, exactly. One of the things that farms, people actually with their farms and all this are completely washed out. So there's a serious crops failure. And their houses and home estates completely are submerged underwater.
Flooding occurs every year around this time, but this year flood waters have reached unprecedented levels. According to local and state officials, many South Sudanese have been coping with floods since July. Information Minister Michael Makuei told reporters, President Kiir declared a state of emergency yesterday.
This is in order to enable the government and the other institutions, governments of people of goodwill, is in order to enable them reach these people and render them the necessary required services. As you know very well, usually water comes with a lot of waterborne diseases and some other things.
The hardest hit areas of flooding are in the Bahar El Ghazal region of Lol, Gogrial, Twitch, Tonj, Abyei, Awil East, and Awil West, according to the government. In the greater Upper Nile region, Maban, Longechuk, Maiwut, Ulang, Fangak, Nasir, Ayot, Boma Estate, Duk, Nyirol, Bor, and Akobo are particularly hard hit. In the Equatorial region, Makuei says Terekeka, Mangala, Rokon, and Lafon have experienced the worst flooding. The national government is mobilizing resources to reach out to the affected population, according to Makuei. He did not elaborate.
Even if we begin to move today, we will not be in a position to reach all the areas that are gone. This is why we are appealing to the region and to the international community at least to move in also on the other side, so that wherever Sudan, South, the government has gone, then they cover the other areas.
Nyot says he met with officials from several aid agencies to ask for financial support to aid flood victims, but was told their funding for this year has come to an end.
The government also, I believe our president and the government will commit some resources, okay, towards this, because as a responsible government, indeed, we need to give our contribution before we ask other people.
The United Nations Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs, or UNOCHA, said last week that since July, 908,000 people have been affected by abnormally heavy seasonal floods across the country. OCHA says its scores of villages and towns across the country are underwater, including health facilities and nutrition centers located in those areas. OCHA says a lack of access to basic services, including proper sanitation, has increased the spread of diseases due to contaminated water. More rain is expected in November, which Nyot says will worsen conditions for the affected populations beyond harvest time.
There will be real famine, there will be hunger, because, you know, if people have not harvested this year and all the crops are washed out and their animals are dying because of they are staying in water, you know, like cattle and all this.
And Nyot says that means the dry season is going to be, in his words, a disaster. Heavy rain is expected to continue for the next 6 weeks. For VOA News, I am Lesuba Memo in Juba.
President Salva Kiir has ordered the Ministry of Finance to stop shipment of 18 cargoes of crude oil to a company known as MS MIMS General Trading LLC. The finance ministry asked the petroleum ministry to send the oil to the company, reportedly to clear a debt the government owed to MIMS. Civil society activists want the government to be more transparent about the country's oil revenues. Onan Walter Solomon has more for VOA from Juba.
Finance Minister Salvatore Garang wrote to Petroleum Minister Wo Daniel Chuang on October 21st, asking him to approve the allocation of the crude oil to MS MIMS General Trading LLC. In a letter on Monday, the minister in the office of the president, Maik Aideng, ordered Garang to reverse his decision. In the letter, which was signed by South Sudan in Focus, Deng writes, "The Ministry of Finance and Planning is directed to devise its own internal mechanisms on how to pay creditors demanding payments from the government for the goods and services rendered to the government." Presidential spokesman Atenue Kateny explains why the shipment of crude oil was cancelled.
The president was not even aware of the allocation of that 18 cargoes. So the cancellation came as a result of the fact that the president did not know, and the president has already instructed the oil sector to be the one selling the oil, and all the contracts that are to be paid for would be paid for by the Ministry of Finance after the oil has been sold.
Deputy Finance and Planning Minister John Dormajok says his office welcomes the president's decision to cancel the shipment, although the office never received an official directive.
If the government sees to it that what has been done earlier, if anything has been done earlier, is not acceptable, then it is natural that the government can decide to cancel those cargoes. I was told, I saw it on the internet, that 18 cargoes, but I think it's a good step.
Jamai David Kolok, Executive Director for Local NGO Foundation for Democratic and Accountable Governance, says the government must be transparent about what it does with oil revenues. Kolok says South Sudan probably loses millions of dollars a year through what he calls dubious oil deals that could undermine the government's ability to provide basic services to citizens. Kolok says the cancellation could mean cancellations of future crude oil shipments to companies in deals that were not transparent to begin with.
How much money do we have as a country, and what is that money being used for? The second point is that this should send a message not only to the civil society and the citizens of this country, but also to the members of parliament, that they have got responsibility in ensuring that they exercise high level of oversight in terms of the usage of resources, especially by the executive, as a way of fighting corruption.
Deputy Finance Minister Majok says a committee within the Ministry of Petroleum determines the amount of crude oil sent to oil trading companies, but the government has stopped the pre-financing of such deals.
If there are oil issues that might have been, for example, approved earlier by that committee, well, they may still be there, but maybe the government is not even interested to see to it that those ones are done. But what I know is that there's a committee in the Ministry of Petroleum that makes the bidding for those who would be interested to bid to lift our cargoes. And this is now the norm that is now prevailing. Any other norm has been stopped by the government.
Salwa Gabriel Berberi, Chief Executive Officer for Berberi Academy, a private enterprise that specializes in capacity building and skills development for advancing good governance in South Sudan, says Chapter 4 of the Revitalized Peace Deal lays out how oil revenues should be managed.
There are too many accounts going on in the petroleum sector, and there are clear instructions from the R agreement, or the revitalized agreement, that some of these accounts must close.
Petroleum Minister Awo Daniel Chuang did not answer repeated phone calls or text messages for comment. For VOA News, I am Onan Walter Solomon in Juba.
Yei River State authorities say National Salvation Front rebels ambushed the governor's convoy yesterday that was traveling to the Democratic Republic of Congo on official business. A resident says he saw bodies lying on the ground at the scene of the ambush, but a government official disputes that account. Daniel Friday Martin has details for VOA from Yei.
Yei River State Deputy Governor Yusto Baba Dima says Governor Emmanuel Adil Anthony was leading a delegation to the DRC Congo for a meeting in Aba Town with the governor of DRC's Luele province when his convoy fell into an ambush by Nas rebels in Abegi village about 9 miles from Yei.
They had actually wanted to attack a particular vehicle of His Excellency the governor, but fortunate enough that they could not reach to that. That was indeed a violation of the agreement. We, the government of Yei River State, strongly condemn these activities, in which we always call for them to come for peace, to come and discuss and abide by the peace agreement.
Speaking in his native Kakwa dialect, a Rubeke village resident who prefers to bed and fight as Moses for fear of reprisals tells South Sudan in Focus he saw at least 4 bodies in military uniform.
Some injured soldiers were brought to Yei, and I also saw about 4 dead bodies on the ground. We are now living in fear because there is no peace in the village. We are subjected into looting at gunpoint.
Moses says villagers were frightened by the shooting between government forces and rebels in the area. Deputy Governor Yusto Baba Dima denies anyone was killed in the ambush.
I completely denounce this information. This information is not true that people were killed. The convoy of the governor yesterday, we have only a first lieutenant that was injured on his leg. We have a soldier who has also a small, it's like dislocation. Both of them are okay. The third person is got just pain from the chest because he jumped out, he fell down, but nobody died.
Dima condemned the attack, but at the same time urged the international community and regional bloc IGAD to engage NAS leader Thomas Rilo in peace talks.
I would like to appeal to the international community to talk to the leader of NAS group to advise his commanders on ground to stop killing innocent people, abducting innocent people, attacking convoys, which is completely not accepted, especially in Yei River State, is taken to be an area of insecurity.
National Salvation Front spokesman Samuel Suba was unavailable for comment. His phone appeared to have been switched off. Last week, NAS rebels clashed with government forces in Morobo County, killing at least 3 aid workers from the International Organization for Migration, according to IOM officials who said they were ending Ebola monitoring activities at the South Sudan DR border due to the deadly violence. For VOA News, I'm Daniel Friday Martin in Yei.
You're tuned to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Outside negotiators try to ease tensions over the Grand Ethiopian Renaissance Dam. Find out more when we come back.
What do you think? People speak out on important questions. The question today:
do you think the current younger generation is disrespectful? Why or why not?
I don't think they are disrespectful. I think we haven't taught them general cultural behavior patterns for the African. We have tended to bring them up more as Western people. So we haven't passed on the African way of respect.
Not all, yeah. Maybe those who have been raised properly in good homes. But I also think the result of this disrespect and bad behavior is the breakage of homes.
I think they are disrespectful because looking at the olden times, people respected culture. People respected elderly people. But today, they don't think about whether this person is older than me or not.
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA.
South Sudan in Focus is now on WhatsApp. Send us a message on +1 202-630-8011. Tell us what's happening in your area or give us your feedback on the stories you hear on South Sudan in Focus. We look forward to hearing from you on WhatsApp. That number again, +1 202-630-8011.
You're listening to South Sudan in Focus. Following a recent meeting in Russia, Egyptian President Abdel Fattah al-Sisi and Ethiopian Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed agreed to resume deadlocked technical negotiations on the Grand Ethiopian Renaissance Dam. Meanwhile, the U.S. has offered a mediation headed by the U.S. Treasury Secretary on November 6th, aiming at reaching a pact on conditions for operating the dam and to set a timetable for filling the reservoir behind it. Joseph Siegel, the director of research at the Africa Center for Strategic Studies, spoke with VOA senior analyst Mohamed Al-Shanawi about the latest efforts to avoid a conflict over water rights.
Well, I see this as a positive development. This dispute is, since a technical issue, it's a question about how quickly the dam should be filled in order that it doesn't affect the downstream availability of water for Egypt. And I think all sides have recognized that Egypt has very significant strategic interest in ensuring the access to the water. And really, so the question is, what's the best means for filling up that dam and agreeing on technical terms how best to do that?
But the work of the technical committee had failed to produce an agreement despite years of discussions between officials from Egypt, Ethiopia, and Sudan. What could make it succeed this time?
I think it should be recognized that the technical committee, by most accounts, was seen to be making progress prior to the Egyptians pulling out earlier this year and complaining that the talks were stalled. In fact, the sense was that they were dealing with very serious and complicated issues in a constructive, multilateral manner. And the process is important because identifying the correct rate of filling the dam will be important for ensuring that it doesn't affect the downstream flow. But it also creates an important factual foundation of understanding that if all sides agree and understand on the technical issues, then that provides the basis for resolving any subsequent policy issues that may result or emerge with regards to the dam. So I think this is all a very important step in creating a strong foundation for an ongoing means for managing the dam once it's completed.
The U.S. offered a mediation headed by Secretary of Treasury early November to reach a pact on conditions for operating the dam and the timetable for filling the reservoir behind it. Is that still valid after Ethiopia refused any mediation on the technical issues?
I think whether or not meetings take place is still an open question. Prime Minister Ami, I believe, said that he's open to dialogue on a political level, and such talks could be useful for providing assurances among the political leaders involved. However, I think one needs to be cautious that we don't create two separate and parallel means of negotiation. There is already this existing technical committee where there have been very detailed discussions about what needs to take place. And so you don't want to undermine that from the political meeting. I think from the Ethiopian perspective, the advantage of having this sort of high-level discussion would just be to provide assurances to President Sisi and the Egyptians that their interests are being considered and that there will be confidence-building measures built into any agreement.
Earlier this month, Ethiopian Prime Minister warned that Ethiopia could deploy millions of people in the event of an armed conflict with Egypt. Would such scenario emerge if the technical negotiations failed again?
Prime Minister Abiy, when he said that, he also said, you know, war is not a solution. And I think he and in previous occasions, President Sisi has also said that they are not seeking war. So this issue should not be one that leads to any sort of armed conflict. It's a technical issue that can be resolved through ongoing negotiations. And I think you know, these sorts of statements are really just posturing between the sides to show the high level of engagement that they have on the matter.
That was Joseph Siegel, the director of research at the Africa Center for Strategic Studies, speaking with VOA's Mohamed El-Shenawy. After a recent spate of killings of opposition representatives in Rwanda, opposition leaders say they're not giving up on forming an opposition party to contest in the 2024 presidential elections. Ruud Elmendorp reports from Kigali.
Economically speaking, the sky seems to be the limit in Rwanda, which is enjoying 8% annual growth, universal health care, and improved education. But according to de facto opposition leader Victoire Ingabire, only the rich eat the fruits of prosperity. She says anyone who dares to say this in public gets harassed by government officials and in the worst case gets killed.
Of course, I am afraid one times, but I don't accept to stay in the fire, to live in the fire, because we need really to struggle for democracy in our country.
Ingabire herself spent 8 years in prison after trying to run against longtime President Paul Kagame in 2010. So far this year, two opposition leaders have been killed in Rwanda. Human Rights Watch researcher Audrey Wabwire says an investigation shows the government was likely involved in their deaths.
Sometimes when someone is killed, the evidence suggests that this is something the government is behind. And it would be good to have concrete answers to these things. That's why we push the government to investigate and find out who is involved and why these killings continue.
The Rwandan government has not responded to HRW's claim it likely had a role in the deaths. Ingabire continues her mission, even though the killers haven't been arrested. Here she shows a slum area of Kigali, where people live with hardly any clean water or electricity. The area is just a kilometer away from Kigali's affluent city center.
You can see the growth of economy only in Kigali. But what we need is to divide this with among all Rwandese people.
Ngabire is working to get a FDU Inkingi party acknowledged. She says it has enough members, but the registration has never come through. 23-year-old Josiane Ingabire is an opposition party member.
Yeah, of course, I'm still very young, but the reason why I choose to be in opposition is the situation that I see around, that I see on my young age, and I ask how we'll be in my old years.
Ingabire hopes to have her FDU Inkingi registered in time to challenge Kagame again in 2024.
If my political party will be registered, I will participate. But the priority for us is not to participate in the election, it's to get up political space, that political space is open up in Rwanda. It is our priority.
And if Victoire Ingabire gets her way, a strong opposition and more wealth will roll to the people of Kigali and beyond. Ruud Elmendorp for VOA News, Kigali, Rwanda.
Most residents of Nairobi do their cooking on stoves powered by firewood, charcoal, or kerosene. The stoves emit smoke and fumes that contribute to deadly respiratory diseases and release harmful carbon emissions into the atmosphere. But now, a small startup company is offering Nairobi residents an alternative source of energy that makes cooking both cleaner and safer. For VOA, Mohamed Yusuf reports.
Catherine Mutua, she has always used charcoal and gas to cook for her young family, but the source of energy she grew up was becoming too expensive. She found out that she can also cook with another kind of fuel, ethanol.
Kitambo nilikuwa natumia gas na pia jiko.
Mutua says, before I was using the gas and charcoal, I shifted after I was educated how the fuel is cheap, safer for the kids, for the environment. Mutua gets the ethanol from a filling station set up by the Coco Networks, a Nairobi-based startup. The company also sells the ethanol stoves that cost a customer about $70. Regina Anyango runs a food kiosk in Kangemi neighborhood in Nairobi. She says she no longer battles black fumes spilled out of a charcoal stove.
So far, it has been very economical. No fume, faster to use when you're cooking, and then it's easy to control.
According to health experts, fume from charcoal and kerosene contribute to respiratory diseases. They also produce carbon emissions that are heating up Earth's atmosphere. Ethanol, by contrast, is made from food sources like sugar or corn and is considered carbon neutral. Some officials believe this kind of alternative source energy can help reduce the number of trees cut down for the use of charcoal or firewood. Michael Wakoli is a fuel supply manager for the Coco Networks. He tells VOA ethanol is a more practical and convenient fuel to use.
Typically, traditionally, what would happen is that because of the nature of the fuel that you'd use to cook, kerosene, charcoal, you'd be forced to cook outside because of the harmful fumes that you have. But we're giving you an in-house cooking solution, which is 203 meters away you can get for very small bundles, taking care of the fact that you have needs of the pocket and how much it costs, so that you can be able to reach you and have a clean cooking experience, have an enriching experience, and use, of course, ethanol, which is renewable energy.
Wakoli says the filling stations are in a part of Nairobi with huge populations that are usually neglected.
So we have typically targeted the dense markets, so Kawangware, Kibera, Kitengela area, Embakasi, Kahawa West, and things like that, where we can reach as many people as possible, and because knowing the need of the people and being near to them, all right.
Coco Network says its customer base has been growing and now serves up to 3,000 people. Mohamed Yusuf for VOA News, Nairobi.
And that's our show for this Thursday. We leave you with the song Makume by Julian Kanyo. To Juliana Kanyo with the song Makume. I'm Ayen Bior in Washington, and we're glad you can be here. Join us again tomorrow evening for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America.